Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, I am outraged. I am outraged at the outrage of the outrage of the out. Did I do enough of those? Anyways, I'll get to that in a little bit. But before we get to my outrage, let's talk about some movies. I'm going to be talking about Furious 7. I'll also be talking about Effie Gray, Spring, Kimiko the Treasure Hunter, and of course there's going to be news and the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course the world famous DVD roundup. But before we get to any of that, this is how you can get in touch with me. If you want to email me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I am at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Let's roll right into the news. I think last week I talked about The X-Files coming back to Fox for 6 episodes. This is the new trend. There are two big trends that I'm going to be talking about in this news segment. This is the first one of resurrecting old shows. Now, it worked with Arrested Development. I thought that was kind of cool. You know, I liked Arrested Development, but it wasn't perfect to come back. There's a lot of momentum you lose when you have these long stretches of time. They did this with 24, what, a year or two ago, where they did 24 to Live Another Day. Or we've seen this done before, but this is more reminds me of the movies they'd have in the 80s and 90s, where they'd have like a reunion movie, like the Brady Bunch Christmas special, or they would have Walton family reunions. This is essentially what's the modern equivalent of that is. Now, it's neat to see a show come back on Netflix. Like I said, Arrested Development was cool. The X-Files, and we'll see. I don't know. When you get to these dramas and these cult shows, they have to have a certain amount of momentum. And when you have it on Fox, you definitely are shackled by the amount of viewers you need. You don't need to show that hand on Netflix as much. And Netflix is a totally different watching pattern, whereas on Netflix, you can binge watch the whole thing over the course of a day or two. But they're going to be getting some reunions of Full House, Coach, Mr. Show with Bob and David. I don't know. Do we really need a Coach reunion? And isn't everyone going to be like on their deathbed in this? I mean, like, Jerry Van Dyke's in it. He's still alive, but I mean, he's like well into his 80s. This seems like it might end up being a little pathetic when you see these actors that you knew and loved 20 years ago, and they come back and they're just really, really old. Same thing with Full House. Not that I love, I think Full House was a piece of crap, but I know there's a lot of love for these things, but you know, can it really work? Or is it just good? Is this the new fad? I have a feeling this is just more of a fad right now. The next trend that's happening in movies in particular is basically spearheaded by Disney, although other companies have gotten involved in this. And that is Disney developing live action remakes of their original animated films, or sort of reimagining movies in a different venue. Like Maleficent was a reimagining of Sleeping Beauty from the bad girl's point of view. You, of course, had Cinderella that recently came out. They did Oz the Great and Powerful, which was in essence a sequel to The Wizard of Oz. Of course, they had to navigate some rights issues with MGM. The latest one on the development sheet is Mulan, is getting a live action remake, which actually I think could be really cool. I was never a huge fan of Mulan. I think it's a good movie, but it's something that could really be an epic, awesome movie. Whereas like Cinderella, as beautiful as that was, it's Cinderella. There's only, I mean, it's been done to death, but Mulan hasn't. And I think it could go for a big treatment. They're doing a Dumbo remake with Tim Burton. They're saying live action, but I don't think it's going to be a really live action elephant with ears the size of airplane wings. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Mulan can work, but I don't know how far we can take this, but we'll see what else comes down the pike when they do like The Lion King and The Little Mermaid. And I know they're doing a Beauty and the Beast adaptation that's coming up. The next piece of news I want to talk about is Ryan Reynolds has come out and confirmed Deadpool, the standalone movie based on the Marvel character Deadpool, will be rated R. Now, he's assured us of this. People seem to forget that Ryan Reynolds, this is the fourth time he'll be in a comic book movie. He played Green Lantern to very sour reviews. He played the original version of Deadpool in the X-Men Origins movie. Nobody liked that. And he was in Blade Trinity, which I actually liked, but nobody else did. So Ryan Reynolds, while he works for the Deadpool character, I'm not terribly familiar, I never read the books for this one, he has no control over whether this is R. That's the thing that I find amazing, is people are clamoring for this. Yes, Deadpool has to be rated R. It may be rated R, but not because of Ryan Reynolds. Ryan Reynolds has no say in the final rating. And you know what? If they do test audience and this thing doesn't track well, they may just cut a PG-13 movie. I believe as much this is going to be rated R, as much as I believed Chuck Norris that Expendables 2 was going to be rated PG-13, which he had demanded in order to be in the movie, and they made it R anyways. Here's the problem. Comic book movies are not well known for their R-rated films. And the ones that are R-rated, that do well, are stuff that people forget are comic books initially. They forget they came from that medium, like Wanted. I think the highest grosser was 300, which you realize is a comic book movie because it's based on a Frank Miller piece, but it's not like Batman. It's not a well-known character. And it's definitely not a superhero. 300, Wanted, Kingsman. The only one that's actually like a bona fide superhero movie that people identify as a superhero movie is Watchmen, and that only made like $107 million. And while Deadpool doesn't have the huge budget that the other X-Men movies have, or the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies have, they're going to want to make money on this. Fox is going to want to make money on this. And this is a real gamble. I know there's a lot of people out there who love, love, love R-rated stuff, and that's great. You can like that. But don't get mad when they decide to spend a lot of money and then make a movie PG-13. They got to make the money. Deadpool's coming out in February, which bodes well for the fact that it could do well as an R-rated movie. But we'll see. I mean, if this doesn't test well as an R-rated movie, or if the studio gets cold feet, it will be PG-13. And they will be unapologetic about it. And Ryan Reynolds will have nothing to do with it. I don't care. I think this belly aching over ratings is stupid sometimes, because I've seen some really good PG-13 movies and I've seen some really terrible R-rated movies that people champion that it was rated R. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. There are two movies I want to talk about today. The first one is Southpaw, directed by Antoine Foucault, who I think is a fantastic director. He's done some great stuff. Like, he just recently did The Equalizer. Southpaw is about Jake Gyllenhaal playing a boxer trying to make a comeback.
This court is aware of the tragedy your family has suffered, Mr. Hope. Nonetheless, you have chosen to demonstrate dangerous behaviors while having custody of your daughter.
Legal custody of the child shall remain with family services
until the father can demonstrate the abilities of a responsible parent.
You want me to come with you?
No, man. I gotta do this alone.
So what brings Billy Hope into my job?
I'm looking for a job, maybe a place to trade.
You couldn't handle the rules here, man.
I can't lose my daughter.
It's releasing July 31st, which is a little odd because that's kind of early for what kind of movie this is supposed to be. This feels like it's an Oscar contender. It might be too violent. Here's the thing. Boxing movies have always done pretty well. Especially Rocky movies. But ultimate fighting movies never have caught on. You had stuff like Warrior and you had Here Comes the Boom. So far that hasn't caught on at all, period. And this feels more like an extreme fighting movie than it does feel like a boxer movie if you go by the trailers. That could hurt it. And being dropped into the end of July, which is essentially the summertime frame, this feels like an October movie. The next movie I want to talk about is Spectre. We finally got the James Bond trailer. This one opens on November 6th.
Forensics finally released this.
What is it?
Personal effects they recovered from Skyfall.
Welcome, James. It's been a long time. And finally, here we are.
I have mixed feelings about this, mainly because there's no sense of story or action in this movie whatsoever. And it feels overly grim, and I think people are going to look back at the James Bond movies and say, yeah, it was kind of cool that they tied things together from movie to movie and didn't just make it actioner after actioner. But I think these are starting to get a little too grim. They're doing very well for the time, but I think they're almost steering too far away from the original feel of Bond. I'd love to get back to some more fun James Bond. And I thought that Skyfall, as well as it did, and as good as the movie was, I think it veered away from the fun James Bond a little too much. I want a good old-fashioned Bond movie, and that's what I'm looking for, and I'm just hoping that Spectre actually can deliver that, as well as give a story that is new and different and significant. So, we'll see in November. That's it for this. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Effie Gray and Spring. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys in the Movies coming back at you. We are going to be talking about some more somber, more serious movies this segment. The first one is Effie Gray. This true story follows the young wife of Victorian art critic John Ruskin, who rejects her and marginalizes her throughout their marriage.
You can't marry him.
When I love him so much.
He's rich and famous, and I'll never see you again.
Congratulations.
Welcome to the family.
You have married no ordinary man.
This was purchased in celebration of your nuptials. John's writing has made painting so celebrated.
What shall we do? What do married people do?
I have as little idea as you.
I keep thinking I've made a terrible mistake.
It is just the married life.
She's not happy.
No more were you at the beginning.
This is actually written by Emma Thompson, and a lot of people, everyone knows who Emma Thompson is. I mean, she's a well-known actress and very respected, and we've seen her in a lot of things. But people forget this woman has won an Oscar for screenplay. I believe she wrote the screenplay for Sense and Sensibility like 20 years ago and won the Oscar for it. In addition to winning the Oscar, for Howard's End or something, as an actor. She's one of those people who's won more than one Oscar for more than one type of work. And people tend to forget that. It's sort of like Ben Affleck. People forget he's got a writing Oscar. And he didn't get an Oscar for directing because he wasn't nominated, but he got Oscars for producing Argo, which is a fantastic movie. So Emma Thompson wrote this movie, which is a true story, and it's weirdly been delayed because apparently two lawsuits have fought this movie trying to claim that she took their idea, and she's prevailed in both of them, which is ridiculous because it's a true story. I mean, it's really, really tough to say, well, you're stealing our idea based on this true story that we're stealing from history. But here's the thing. It's a Victorian era movie. And one of the biggest problems that I've seen, especially recently, in like the last 10 or 15 years, in Victorian era movies, there is an attempt to make them look as realistic as possible, which is true. In the Victorian era, that was during the Industrial Revolution. There was a lot of pollution, a lot of coal, a lot of dirt in the air. And they didn't have indoor electricity. So everything's lit by candlelight. So it's very dim and drab and pallid and dull looking at times. Sometimes cinematographers, they want to make that look good because they want to find the beauty in the drabness. And the problem is, I've seen a lot of this movie called In Secret a year or two ago. Same thing. It's very drab and very dull to look at. And where this could have been really rife with possibilities of a Victorian era soap opera, this movie just doesn't capitalize on anything, and it's just very dull because these people's lives were dull. You watch a film like this, you'd be like, would I rather have been one of the poverty-stricken masses who has to work 20 hours a day just to get by, or would I want to be the idle rich? Because the idle rich are boring. Watch movies like this and it's just dull. They don't even have hobbies because they're women in Victorian era. They can't do anything. The story behind this movie is way more fascinating than the movie itself. I mean, in real life, and they depict it in this film, but Effie Gray, she was like 12 when she met this guy, and then when she finally turned 18, he married her, and they supposedly had this romance, but he rejected her on her wedding night. No one really knows why. Did he not realize what a woman looked like naked down there? I mean, they didn't have bikini waxing back in the Victoria era. And I mean, there's a lot of speculation of what this was. And maybe he was so into art and the nudes that were hairless and perfect and these beautifully artistic painting, and then a woman, and then his wife, who's, when she's naked, isn't, of course, you know, it's basically the Victorian equivalent of a man going home and being upset because his wife isn't a swimsuit model for Sports Illustrated. There's some really great things that could happen in here, but it's just dull. And it's good, well acted, very well cast, beautifully shot. The only oomph that it has is Emma Thompson shows up at one point as Effie Gray's confidant. And she's kind of interesting. She's a great character. She's very interesting. She's commanding of the screen and she's confident. And then she leaves. You know, she serves her purpose but she's in like two or three scenes and then that's it. And the rest of the movie is just dull and drab and pallid. And it's kind of left me bored. As cool as the story is and as fascinating as the story is, it squanders all it on just trying to be another dull Victorian era drama. So I'm going to have to say Effie Gray kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Spring from Drafthouse Films. A young man travels to Italy to center himself after the death of his mother and ends up falling in love with a woman who has a dangerous and mysterious secret.
I'm Evan.
Louise.
I've been seeing this Italian girl. She's really pretty.
So I only get to see you at night.
Our nights together must remain a secret.
She acts kind of weird sometimes, and I found something that gives me some doubt.
I have a medical condition that comes and goes, and it's a very long story.
I gotta make sure you're the kind of crazy I can deal with.
I think you could be the love of my life.
I don't think you're ready for where this is going.
I'm gonna tiptoe around this quite a bit, simply because to talk too much about what makes this movie interesting spoils a lot of the movie. Suffice to say, there's this weird, almost supernatural element to it. And it's not what you would immediately expect, which is cool. Because I saw where this was going and I'm like, oh, is this what the twist is going to be? Is it just going to be this? And I'm like, no, it wasn't just that. There was a lot more to it. Now, it's not laid out as well as it could be. When it reveals what the actual story behind this is and what the actual secret that this woman has, it's not presented as well as it could be, but it's got some fascinating concepts tied to it. And that's what I really liked about this movie. The main character, the guy who travels to Italy to fall in love, I'm not a wild fan of this kind of character. He's a bit of this weepy, emotional, sort of lost 20-something guy, which every generation has that, going all the way back to the baby boomers. You had the guy in his 20s who was trying to find himself in the world. I mean, I remember watching Say Anything, which came out, I think, in 1990, which was John Cusack and Ione Skye. It was a Cameron Crowe movie. And I'm actually responsible for blowing the perfect 100% on Rotten Tomatoes for that movie. Because I gave it a bad review, and I've gotten hate mail for that. But that movie is a quintessential example of a guy who is sort of a wandering poet, so to speak. Not really a poet, but that's the attitude it has. And he's just trying to find love, and it's all about emotion and experiencing the moment. And this is just basically that same kind of story, the same kind of character for the millennials. I mean, he's this guy who doesn't know what he wants to do, and he's struggling with his friends and his family and dealing with the baggage from that. And he meets this girl and he just, oh, I just love you. I love you so much. And I'm just falling in love with you. And it lays it on so thick at times. And he's not a strong character. He's a bit of a wimpy, modern type of love interest for a guy, which, like, again, I guess is not terribly modern because I've seen this character many times before, movies going back to the 70s, but it's just the millennial version of that. So he's kind of boring, and she is a bit of a snoot at times, and it makes sense when you find out her real story. But when they finally reveal what the elements are that make this movie unique, it's interesting. It's not great, and the acting's okay. The concepts are cool. It's not as executed as well as it could be, but it's at least an interesting, different take on a millennial love story. So I'm going to have to say Spring kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That is it for those two movies. In the next segment, I'm going to be talking about Furious 7 and Kimiko the Treasure Hunter. I'll see you back here in a minute. Car with Fat Guys at the Movies, coming at you with some more movie reviews. Let's drive straight to the big movie of the weekend, and that is going to be Furious 7. Dominic Toretto leads his team on an international hunt for a dangerous piece of technology while running from a hitman out for revenge.
Remember Owen Shaw? This is his big bad brother. He's a special forces assassin. They created a monster.
Looks like the sins of London have followed us home.
We're being hunted.
Shaw lives in a world that doesn't play by your rules. Like it or not, you and your friends are a part of it now.
I don't have friends. I got family.
I am so conflicted at times with the Fast and Furious franchise because it has been all over the map. No pun intended. I was not a big fan of the first couple. It took me a long time to actually warm up to this series. I thought the first Fast and Furious was fine for what it was. And the second one was kind of terrible because Tyrese Gibson. And the third one was really terrible. There are people I know who think the third one, Tokyo Drift, is the best of the series. It's not. And usually what's funny with like the first three movies, both the films, the second one and the third one, you can rest most of the suckiness of these movies on one person's shoulder. In the second one, it's Tyrese Gibson, who's awful in it. And in the third one, it's Lucas Black. He's awful. He's terrible. There's a reason he comes back in Furious 7 in a cameo, a small bit, one scene part. But there's a reason they haven't revisited him at all. And why he's never been brought in, aside from sort of chronology of the series. The first three movies aren't very good. And the fourth movie is... it's trying to become what it eventually becomes, but it kind of misses the mark at times, and it runs a little long, and it gets a little goofy. And while I thought Fast and Furious, which is the fourth movie, really started things off, it didn't really gel until, like, the end of the fifth movie. Because Fast 5 was cool, but it drags in the middle, and it has some really silly character moments. Fast and Furious 6 is actually pretty entertaining. I liked Fast and Furious 6, and that's when I'm like, okay, I can start getting into this series of movies. As ridiculous as the tank scene was, Fast and Furious 6, I think, is where the series was in full stride. It hits stride in Fast 5, and it gets to Fast and Furious 6. And now Furious 7. And you can't talk about this movie without talking about Paul Walker and the fact that he died in a crash in the middle of production. I'm curious as to where the series would have gone with him, because I think they could have really made 10 more movies with this whole team. Furious 7 takes it to a ludicrous level. The last couple movies, they defy physics in those movies. Here, they just ignore physics. This movie is essentially, it's a Looney Tunes cartoon. They're made of rubber. There is a scene where somebody's injured and is in a cast and just busts out of the cast to do what they got to do. I mean, it's the equivalent of Daffy Duck getting shot in the face with a shotgun and his bill ending up upside down over his neck and then shaking it off. That's what happens in these movies. I mean, it is just ludicrous. But doggone it if it's not entertaining. Because it's become just a giant action set piece. And I think actually the pacing, Justin Lin passed the reins on to James Wan for this movie, and I think the action works really well. James Wan does some really cool stuff. Like I said, he goes more ridiculous than Justin Lin, which is kind of unbelievable when you've watched the last two movies and what they end up accomplishing. The writing is terrible. The one-liners are cringe-worthy. And there are some moments that you just like. Ronda Rousey is in this movie, and she had her big screen debut. She may have shown up in something small, but sort of like a high profile movie was Expendables 3, and she was awful in that, playing against Ketlin Lutz. That's what killed the movie. She is an attractive woman. She's not gorgeous, but she's an attractive woman, and she's very good at what she does, meaning she's very good at kicking the snot out of people in the ring. An actor, though, she is not. She is not a good actor. And I know there have been all these stories that floated around Facebook where Ronda Rousey punches out some guy who said she's stupid or hits like a girl. Oh, no, no. I am confident that Ronda Rousey can kick anybody's butt, including mine. but she is not a good actor. In fact, in this movie, she plays a bit part. It's high profile, but she plays a bit part. And she has, I mean, like three lines. And she can't even manage to cough those lines out coherently. Gina Carano was in the last movie, and Gina Carano has had her hand at trying to become an action star. And she has a small talent for acting, and I've seen her actually do some decent stuff. But not Ronda Rousey. Ronda Rousey has no idea how to act. She's awful. And that's with her going up against Michelle Rodriguez, which, you know, Michelle Rodriguez isn't the greatest actor on the planet either. But, you know, the action is ridiculous. They're dropping cars out of planes, which is interesting because there are bits and pieces of this movie where I'm like, well, they stole that from Transporter 2. They stole that from Need for Speed. They stole that from this. There's a lot of things where you see sampled where James Wan has picked and chosen other action scenes from other movies and sort of meshed them all together. There's always a scene of them going to a street racing and girls dancing around in short skirts and thongs. You see probably more butts in this movie than if you were to look into an ashtray at the state fair. I mean, there is so many short skirts and thong butts in this movie. It's kind of mind-boggling at times. I'm okay with that, though. And finally, they do a great job giving a send-off to Paul Walker. I mean, Paul Walker, he was part of their family, their off-screen family, and they loved each other. You can totally tell. You ever hear Vin Diesel talk about Paul Walker, you know that there's a lot of care for each other. And it's very sad what happened to him. And it's very sad that it happened to this group of people who are in these movies that do very well together. They enjoy making them. And they give him a send-off. They do him very well. And you can tell when they're using face replacement and a body double. You can tell that the movie was unfinished and it's not exactly what James Wan and everyone else wanted. And they tug at the heartstrings, but they're not gratuitous on it. It's very heartfelt and thoughtful, and they revere him. And that's great. So it's very sad and poignant at times. I wouldn't call it a great movie, but I had a lot of fun watching it. So I'm going to say it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Kumiko the Treasure Hunter. An unbalanced Japanese woman travels to America in order to find a satchel of money buried in the film Fargo.
Are you an exchange student or a tourist?
Yes. I discover treasure right here.
I want to help you. I'm just trying to figure out how.
You take me to treasure.
I'll take you to the Mall of America. It's a lot more fun.
I'm sure you may have heard this urban legend, and I say it's an urban legend. Something really happened. A woman did travel from Japan searching for the satchel of money of Fargo to a very tragic. And it made news. Apparently, it was a misrepresentation of what really happened. I think she had traveled from Japan to meet like somebody she was having an affair with, and the people misconstrued her going there to find the satchel of money from Fargo, even though she somehow went to very similar places. But, you know, don't let the truth stand in the way of filmmakers making a movie. So they made this film about this Japanese woman who honestly believes the money hidden in Fargo is there, even though it was shot years beforehand and takes place years before that. I mean, this woman's unbalanced, but she's played by Rinko Kikuchi, and she's very charming and sweet and kind of surprisingly cute in this movie, even though she's a whole bag of crazy. And it's a heartbreaking movie at times. It's also a befuddling movie. It's not an overt laugh out loud comedy. It kind of takes that Fargo approach, the Coen brothers approach, where it's off kilter and the comedy and the humor can be found in the very strange and off-putting at times situations. It doesn't glorify Japan or America either. It sort of revels in the depression of each, we'll say. It wallows in the problems you're going to have in Japan, and it wallows in the problems you're going to have in the Midwest, in Minnesota. This is an interesting enough movie. It's different. It's not like anything you're ever going to see else out this year, and that is always kind of worth a shot. So if you can find it in your local listing or catch it on demand, you know, it's worth checking out. I wouldn't speed through a school zone to go check this movie out, but it's worth a rental, or at the very least, you know, checking it out on a matinee. So Kumiko the Treasure Hunter kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the movie reviews. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about an outrageous Fat Guy sound off. the box office, and the world-famous DVD roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And here we are back for the final segment of Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Sorry to have to go here. I got one more segment to do. I know you're all weeping and crying in your oatmeal because you want to hang around with me and spend the rest of the weekend with me. I would love to do that with each and every one of you. I absolutely, totally would. But I've got napping on the couch to get done. Let's talk first about the Fat Guy Sound Off before we move into the final desserts of the show. The Fat Guy Sound Off this week is about outrage culture and the fact that it's dumb. I'm not even going to bury the lead on this one. It's dumb. Outrage culture is insane. And it's become so prevalent in this day of social media because people can read a story, get outraged by it, write a post on Facebook, and then they feel like they've done something, which usually doesn't do jack squat. There's been so many things that have been causing outrage in the last couple of weeks. But the thing I really want to focus on, since it's related to entertainment, is Trevor Noah being tapped to take over Jon Stewart in The Daily Show. I actually don't watch The Daily Show. I just don't have time. And apparently he's done some correspondence work there, and they brought him in. And he's going to take over Jon Stewart. And I think a lot of people are already just outraged because Jon Stewart's not going to be replaced by Jon Stewart. There are people who love The Daily Show, and Jon Stewart does a fantastic job. And he built the show from just a dumb show that Craig Kilborn hosted to a premier comedy showpiece that also got very irreverent with politics. And he became a force. Jon Stewart made The Daily Show into something amazing. And I sort of applaud Comedy Central for trying not to just replace him with another Jon Stewart. Because you never will. You're never going to get Jon Stewart 2.0 to do The Daily Show. You got to have somebody make it their own. And they got to find their own place. And so they took somebody who's very, very different, very, very young. And they got Trevor Noah. Well, after that was announced, I think it was BuzzFeed, one of the worst websites out there, digs through his Twitter feed and finds, I mean, years ago, tweets that he sent out that were quote-unquote offensive. Now, I've read some of the tweets. I got bored with them after a while. They're not really that offensive. He comes from South Africa, and his father's black South African, and I think his mother's Jewish. I think that's how it works out. He's of mixed race, and it's important to note that he comes from a Jewish family, because the jokes he was making, people are saying, were anti-Semitic. And I'm like, there's a difference if you're coming from a Jewish family, or at least from a Jewish mother, and you're making Jewish jokes. There's a difference between that and if you're a WASP doing that. By that account, Mel Brooks should be fired from everything. I mean, throughout the years, all of his movies. I mean, I'm not even talking about like stuff he does now. One of his first movies, The 12 Chairs, was a whole bag of Jewish jokes. What are we getting offended over with this? Here's the thing. Trevor Noah is a comedian, and comedians need to work their material. The best comedian on the planet does not just come out there and throw out a joke and have it work the first time. And there's a great movie. It's called Comedian. I recommend people seeing it because it's a fascinating film. And it was made right after Seinfeld ended. And Jerry Seinfeld said, okay, he's going to scrap all of his current material and he's going to develop new material. And to a comedian, that's a big deal. What this movie did is it shows him working to develop a new set of material. And it's a fascinating movie because it shows the crap that he has to go through and working the stuff out at clubs. And you see Jerry Seinfeld, who at the time was the biggest comedian on the planet, and you just see him bombing and not doing his stuff right. You got to work the stuff. A dancer doesn't go out there and dance without rehearsals. And a musician doesn't go out there without practicing their performance. When they make movies, they run these movies through test audiences and they get feedback. you got to get feedback from other people on your stuff. And so this was him working his material. Now, comedians should probably, you know, take note that you probably shouldn't work all your material out on Twitter, because once it's on Twitter, it's there forever. But at worst, these were mildly offensive jokes about his own heritage. If this were the case, Mel Brooks, like I said, Richard Pryor, George Carlin, none of these people would have careers. And what I'm seeing is people are getting offended at everything. And I actually literally saw somebody on Facebook. He was outraged over the outrage of people being outraged about this. It was like Inception. It was like three levels deep. He was complaining that there was a backlash to the people who were outraged at this in the first place. And this is a guy who, I swear, every little thing that happens, you post some story and he complains about something. And I'm looking at this and I ignore his posts now. When you cry wolf that much over little stupid things like this, when something really does matter, people don't care. Save your outrage for the real problems in this world, not whether Trevor Noah threw out a couple mildly offensive bad jokes. People, chill out. Things move in cycles. This is the political correctness of the 90s rearing its ugly head again. And people just need to back off, because then what ends up happening is you become offended at everything, and then everyone ignores the fact that they're doing anything offensive, and you end up with a society of insensitive jerks again. That's what oversensitivity results in. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about box office really quick. Last week, was I correct? I said $30 million for Get Hard, and I was pretty close. It made about $34. But what surprised me and everyone else was how well Home did. I thought Home was cute. I thought it worked. And it made $52 million, which is the biggest gross that DreamWorks has had for a film that is not a sequel. You know, like all the Shrek movies did extremely well, but those were sequels. This one, just an out-of-the-gate DreamWorks movie. And that's good. It was a cute movie. It works. I think there's a lot of critics and people who just don't like Jim Parsons. But I think the mainstream enjoy him. Home did very well. Get Hard did pretty well for itself, too. $34 million. Not bad for an R-rated comedy. Then he had Divergent and Cinderella. Then It Follows came in with $3.8 million. And there's been a huge rumbling in box office world where people are wondering whether that's a flop or not. I mean, I saw somebody characterize it as an unprecedented flop. And I'm like, no, it's not. That's actually quite good. You see, what you have to do is you have to realize, you know, people, I think they're comparing it to the big horror movies like the Paranormal Activity sequels, Friday the 13th when the remake came out, or something like The Conjuring or Insidious 2. You can't compare that. It Follows is a movie with nobody in it. There is not one recognizable name in that film. There's nobody recognizable associated with that film. This was a movie that was going to video on demand, and like within the last week, they decided to switch it up and then send it out in theaters. So while it got a big advertising push at the end, it was not hyped. You really didn't know it was coming until they did a hurry-up offense and did an advertising campaign in the last week. And when you compare this to some other movies, it's actually pretty good. I mean, you compare it to something like, there was a movie a couple years ago called The Apparition, which starred the one of the girls from Twilight. And that movie made, I think it made a $5 million total. It Follows has almost overcome that. Or look at Tusk, a Kevin Smith movie that got a big release. And it had like Justin Long in it. And it had Genesis Rodriguez. And it had Michael Parks. And it had Haley Joel Osment showing up again. Tusk, it didn't even make $2 million. And you had The Pyramid come out, what, last Christmas? And it didn't even make $3 million. This movie made more than those movies did in their entire run. So the fact that It Follows made as much as, I mean, several million dollars is really good for just a suddenly snuck out release that was on nobody's radar for an independent. This is a huge movie. This is huge. This is, not only is it not a flop, but it's a huge success for what kind of movie it is. Now, if this were a movie and it starred big names and it had a huge advertising push and it had a major studio behind it and it only made $4 million, that's a different story. But yeah, almost $4 million for this movie, and it's expanding even more this weekend. It's doing well for itself. Let's not have a bake sale to save It Follows. It's doing well for itself. This week, of course, Furious 7 is going to win. I'm going to just say an even $100 million. This is the easiest way to do it. I don't know what's going to happen. This could be crazy, but it could also suffer a bit of a backlash because it is so ridiculous. And this is probably going to be the biggest one of the series, simply boosted by the sort of the send-off for Paul Walker. So we'll see. I mean, $100 million, I think, is fair. to say this movie's going to make in its opening weekend. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. Let's burn through these really quick. The first one is Interstellar, which, you know what's funny is there's an honest trailer out for Interstellar, which is brilliant. Even though I appreciated Interstellar, it was not nearly as good as it was supposed to be. And it was the least of a lot of Christopher Nolan movies. So I don't want to talk about that much anymore. The Imitation Game, which was a fantastic movie, with Benedict Cumberbatch as Alan Turing. And then a couple collections. If you're into Italian horror films, Dario Argento has a collection. It's not like his best movies, but it has The Cat of Nine Tails, Deep Red, and Inferno, if you're a big Dario Argento fan. And if you're a Lucio Fulci fan, the Lucio Fulci collection includes City of the Living Dead, The House by the Cemetery, and The New York Ripper, which features a slasher who quacks like a duck. It's actually one of the weirdest slasher movies out there. So the stinker of the week is Wild, even though I know it got nominations and all that stuff. I was bored fiercely by this and Reese Witherspoon's. You get to see her naked at least. Anyways, that is it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about the sure-to-be-horrible Nicholas Sparks movie, The Longest Ride, and While We're Young. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.